Great to be here this morning. So we're going to I'm going to be presenting on the most recent study that's part of a research program that goes back many, many years, and it's generally focused on how the spatial structure of cities and metropolitan regions is driving local climate change and the implications of local climate change, and specifically looking at the urban heat-on effect as a potential driver of heat-related health effects. I want to mention my co-authors on this, Tegan Beamer, who's here in the audience, I think. Dana Habib and Jason Vargo are with me at Georgia Tech. Tegan and Fuyin Yip are at CDC and closely collaborating on this study. Like Vivek, I have nothing to disclose. I regret that. I'm not getting wealthy off of this. If there are corporate sponsors out here who would like to fund this work, you could let me know afterwards, but no, there's nothing to disclose here. So I'm going to be talking about three basic questions here. The first is focused on a study that just came out this year. Are sprawling cities more vulnerable to extreme heat events? And that study really sets the table for the current work that I'm going to be presenting today. Then we're looking at our cities characterized by rapid growth and extreme heat event frequency, experiencing more heat-related mortality. It's one thing to establish that sprawling cities are having more very hot days year after year, but that doesn't necessarily tell us that more people are getting sick from this, so we're trying to identify whether there's an association there. And then finally, whether sprawl is acting as an effect modifier here on extreme heat events and heat-related mortality. There's lots of anecdotal data out there that cities are getting hotter. This was just in September in Los Angeles. We saw some very high temperatures in excess of 110 degrees. I think Jason Pollock here expresses what many people were feeling in Los Angeles with this statement down here, that this is a little shocking to have this happening in September of all times. This was the hottest temperature ever experienced in LA, and it happened in September. And so the extremity of this event is important, but when it's happening is also telling us something important, I think, that it's happening so late in the year. This is entirely anecdotal, of course. There's a lot of evidence out there that cities are getting hotter and that the extremity of these temperatures is increasing over time. And so that's what we focused on in this first study I want to talk about. In this study, we're looking at these trends in these extreme heat events that are increasing across most cities over the last 50 years. And we're asking whether these trends vary by where we are in the country, specifically by the spatial structure of these metropolitan areas. We can think about this in more common terminology as sprawl or compact cities. And so we look at extreme heat events and we compare that to a sprawl index, which is measuring four dimensions of urban form: density, which is pretty familiar to everybody, connectivity, which is essentially the spatial structure of the street network, land use mix, and centeredness. Is it a polycentric or monocentric urbanized region? And this has been shown to be a really effective way of measuring spatial structure, and it actually correlates with a lot of different indicators that are related to transportation and air quality. And so we wanted to look specifically at heat-related events. To do that, we use EHE data that's based on this heat stress index that was first developed by Stedman, which is measuring, it's the apparent temperature, so it's measuring both temperature and humidity, which is a good indicator of heat stress on the human body. Gaffin and Ross used this in really a groundbreaking article in 1998 to show that extreme heat events were increasing over time. And the way they used this heat stress index is they determined there was a threshold at the 85th percentile of a long-term average of temperatures in a specific place. And so the 85th percentile of high temperatures in Atlanta is different than the 85th percentile of high temperatures in Denver. And so when we have an extreme heat event, it depends on where we are. And so it's tied regionally to the climate and to the population of each of these areas. This is, since the publication of this paper, this same index has been maintained by the National Climate Data Center. And so we use this. It's for all of really the largest cities in the US. So this is what we found when we looked at trends since the 1950s in extreme heat events, and we see a pretty consistent pattern. In most cities, we're seeing a greater frequency of very hot days year to year, and the increase is not trivial. It's actually quite significant, about 150% increase in extremely hot days over a 50-year period. And so for the average city, that was an increase of about 12 days. There's some cities where the number of heat event days is increased by a month per year, upwards of 30 days. And so this is presenting a pretty significant challenge in terms of public health and planning. When we look at this with the sprawl index, what the circle diameters now represent is where the city ranks in terms of the sprawl index, in terms of quartiles. So the large circles are the most sprawling cities, and the small circles are the more compact cities. And then the colors are breaking down the frequency of extreme heat events. And so the question here essentially is, do we see more of the sprawling cities are falling into the red category, maybe the red and yellow categories, and are the more compact cities falling into the blue category? And spatially, we generally see that here. It's easier when we actually graph this on our bar graph, and we see a pretty compelling trend here in terms of quartiles of sprawl is as we graduate from one level of sprawl to another, as we move from compact cities to very sprawling cities, we actually see a significant increase in the frequencies of very hot days per year. And so what is driving this? It could be a number of things. We've controlled for geography by using the extreme heat event measure that's tied to that 85th percentile. So one thing that we think is driving this is actually the relationship between sprawl and land cover change. We find that in sprawling cities with their horizontal expansion, we're actually losing lots of that natural land cover to development, to streets and buildings and parking lots. And so do we actually see that in terms of the data? Do we find that there's more deforestation in sprawling cities? It's kind of a, intuitively we would think that's true, but there have been really no studies that have looked at this directly. And so we use a national land cover data set for a single decade within our five-decade period. It's the only decade where we have 10 full years of standardized land cover data across the entire U.S., which is really useful data. And we asked the question, do we see more deforestation in these cities that are sprawling? And we find another pretty clear and consistent trend here, that as we move up the sprawl index, we see more square kilometers of deforestation over this 10-year period. And so we believe that that's contributing to more heat island formation, and that's contributing to more extreme heat events. We also see a clear correlation between the loss of tree canopy cover and the frequency of extreme heat events. So we think all those things are related in a specific way. And so that brings us to our current question. Is heat-related mortality greater in warming cities, these cities that are experiencing more and more extreme heat events? And so this is a really challenging question to ask given the data at hand. And this touches a little bit on what Colleen was describing in her study, is that we're required to use these broad classes of mortality. The coding in terms of heat-related mortality, particularly outside of rather pronounced heat wave events, is not very reliable, the literature tells us. And so often we're looking at cardiovascular mortality, all-cause mortality, maybe respiratory mortality. But if we look at that in terms of the association with extreme heat events, we don't hypothesize that extreme heat accounts for a very large percentage of those deaths. There are many, many things that are causing cardiovascular disease and respiratory disease. And so this is a simple example. If we look at Cleveland, San Diego, for example, they're kind of on either end of the continuum in terms of the growth in very hot days per year. In Cleveland, you've got a pretty high cardiovascular mortality rate, relatively low growth in your extreme heat. And then San Diego's the inverse. You have pretty rapid pace of growth in extreme heat, but a low cardiovascular rate, a low number or count of people who are dying every year in terms of cardiovascular diseases. So one reason this is related to the smoking rate in Cleveland, for example, is much higher. It could be many things. We don't try to distill this. But how this informs our research question is that if you're going to look at actual just broad counts of mortality, it's probably not going to be directly associated with heat. But what might be associated is mortality at the margin. If we look at how cardiovascular and respiratory mortality is changing year to year, is that related with the increase in extreme heat? And so we use that as our variable in this analysis, not the count of mortalities, but how it is increasing or decreasing year after year. Okay, so these are our research questions. Are warming cities experiencing an increase in cardiovascular and respiratory mortality rates, that rate of change year after year? And two, is sprawl modifying the effect of any association we measure? So this is the data we use, the extreme heat events data I already talked about. We're using the CDC's National Vital Statistics System to get these mortality rates for cardiovascular and respiratory disease. These are all age standardized across our 56 metropolitan regions. There's one more point to mention before I get to our results, and that is a complicating factor that we're seeing mortality trends are negative across these cities for this 20-year period we're looking at. We're actually seeing improvement in terms of cardiovascular death rates. So what we are hypothesizing is we're seeing essentially a lessening of that negative trend within cities that are heating up over time. It makes it a little harder to describe. But we think if we're seeing an increase in heat-related mortality in these cities that are warming the most rapidly, it is blunting this trend. And so that's what we're looking for in terms of our data. So this is what the actual data looks like. If we look at, on one axis, the trends in the change in extreme heat events on our x-axis here. So we're seeing a city's increase in terms of the number of extreme heat events per year. And then we graph our cardiovascular mortality rate, that annual change in cardiovascular deaths year after year. We see a positive and significant association here. Cities that are warming the most rapidly are seeing the most pronounced increase, actually a decrease in cardiovascular rates, but a blunting of that negative trend. That's what we see in this region. We certainly can't say it's causal. We just see there's an association here and provides preliminary evidence that we need to look into this further. So that's cardiovascular death rates. In terms of respiratory mortality, we see no relationship at all. If we could come up with a textbook graph for what no relationship looks like, it would be it. That's a perfectly flat line. So our principal hypothesis here is sprawl acting to as an effect modifier in this relationship? Are we seeing a more enhanced association between extreme heat events and cardiovascular death rates in sprawling cities versus non-sprawling cities? And what we see here is there's evidence of a difference in terms of the slopes of these lines, but they're certainly not significantly different. If we look at these two confidence intervals, there's a lot of overlap here. So we do not find, looking at this 20-year period, that sprawl is explaining a significant difference in terms of those two associations. There's suggestion here that perhaps if we look at the data in a different way, if we look across a longer time period where we've seen a more pronounced increase in extreme heat events year after year, we might find a significant difference, but we don't in terms of this first cut at the data. So our basic conclusions here, the rate of decline in age-standardized cardiovascular mortality rates is lowest in regions experiencing an increasing number of extreme heat events between 1987 and 2006, that lessening of the negative trend. We don't find this relationship with respiratory mortality. We do see a difference, but it's not significant in terms of our sprawling cities and our compact cities. All these cities are showing an association between rising heat and changing levels of cardiovascular disease, but we don't see a significant difference at this point. And so these next steps in the study are very important, and we're still at an early phase in the study. We're going to do an examination of extreme heat and mortality trends over a longer period of time, again, because we've got more pronounced change over time. In the initial study I showed you, we looked at 50 years and saw a clear association with sprawl, and so we may see a clear association with sprawl if we look over a longer period of time. We're going to look at a broader set of confounders than just age alone, which is what we control for in this first analysis. And then we're going to look specifically at excess mortality associated with episodes that include both extreme heat and air pollution. And I think when we're looking at the episodic data, we're also more likely to see clearer associations than at the aggregate level where we've been working now. And so that's my final slide. If there are questions during the Q&A for all of us, I'd be thrilled to talk about it more and appreciate your time this morning. Thank you so much.
Well, great. I'd like to thank my presenters for such a continuum of presentations. They're also interrelated. But now we'll open it up to questions. Let's push the clock and see how many we can get in the next 10 minutes or so. Yes, sir.
Yeah, Brian, I was glad to see the last point on your slide because that was a really interesting study you showed us. I really think you've had, by looking at those mortality rates all over the total year,
right?
You just got so much noise in there.
Absolutely.
That I think you're really going to get a lot more sensitivity by looking at excess mortality.
Yeah.
Your conclusions might end up changing after you've worked through that next step.
Right. No, it's a great point. I didn't mention or highlight, we're just looking at warm season. But even just within warm season, it's a very high-level analysis. So, I agree with you. We've got to get down to the episodic data. And we had hoped to at this point and just didn't get there. And so I'm basically showing you what we've got this far along in the study. But I appreciate the comment.
Okay. The rest of the questioning, if you could just stand up, and so that way the individuals in the back can hear your question as well. Dr. Balbus?
So I think we know intuitively, and we know from a lot of the data,
that urban heat island effects and climate mobility is a real micro environment. There's tremendous variation in impact. As heat waves occur, people are more likely to spend a lot more time in an indoor environment than an outdoor environment. So I'm just wondering, in the research that you're looking at, how important do you think it is to really characterize outdoor micro environments versus really looking at vulnerability in terms of housing stock, housing characteristics, poverty, and really trying to characterize the variation in the indoor infrastructure as opposed to really trying to figure out how you're going to characterize what the temperature is out on the street, which you think is more important? Are you looking at that kind of thing?
Is that to all of us, or is that to me in particular? I'll take the first stab at it just because I stood up. You raise a great point, and it's an issue that we're focused on directly. We're actually developing a study now that's going to categorize building stocks and look at interior and exterior exposure. And the other piece here that's really critical when we talk about vulnerability is our grid failures, the likelihood of electrical failures. I mean, because we rely on air conditioning so heavily as this adaptive measure, we don't always have air conditioning available to us. And so I think we need to further expand our definitions of infrastructure and adaptation to consider whether we're more vulnerable in certain parts of the country than others in terms of energy. And I'll turn it over to others who want to address that too.
I'll just quickly comment. Recently, and this is emerging research, is we've connected with the Green Building Research Laboratory on Portland State campus. And their interest has been largely around weatherization and conserving energy over a long time, but it turns out they have a tremendous amount of equipment that would allow one to be able to thermally image what the relationship is between what's the outside environment, characterizing the outside environment, which we can do with satellites and various other technologies, but getting at that microcosm. So what we're essentially working with them on, and what they've already started to, I think, head down this path, is characterizing types, various categories of housing stock, and the thermal efficiencies within those housing stocks, so that while we can talk about weatherization as one side of the coin, we can also talk about kind of the spillover, if you will, from the outside to the inside of various of heat, and whether they have units, whether they have air conditioning units, et cetera, is another question altogether. But at the same time, we can start to kind of tease out that relationship between what the outside temperature is and how that could potentially kind of infuse what's happening inside as well. So yeah, it's an interesting point.
Yes. Lexi Schultz with Media and Concerned Scientists. So thank you. Those were all excellent presentations, really great presentations. And I'm interested in this, particularly with looking at your last point on this slide, whether anyone else is looking at the correlation or the incidence of air pollution with extreme heat and air pollution events, because obviously that's a big factor, and that's also going to be exacerbated with climate change. So interested in that.
In my analysis that, or in our analysis that I presented, we controlled for daily ozone levels because in the literature, I mean, we know that ozone increases with temperature, and any study on heat that doesn't control for ozone is confounded by that factor. So that's what we did to control for that. We didn't include particulate matter, and there's ozone is the one that's clearly associated with temperature, and there's particulate matter is a little more complicated. That's what we did.
Is there any plan to look at that, or perhaps look at sort of the connection? Not eliminate for it, but perhaps add that in.
Yes, I presented on this at Berkeley beforehand, and that was brought up as something that we should look into, and we're planning on looking at that. And people were thinking that possibly the ozone effect is stronger than the heat effect on this example.
Can I quickly ask, we've got what's called a PAETM, Portland Air Toxics Assessment, that's been running for a little while, done by the Department of Environmental Quality, and it's one of these microscale emission models that's not empirical per se, but it's a model looking at land use inventory and essentially what's out there. And what our study has actually found is it's kind of a double whammy. A lot of our heat is along roadways, but a lot of the air pollution from the mobile sources along roadways. So people living along the roadways are, getting hammered twice. And on top of that, what I find interesting is that a lot of the movement to create transit-oriented development, which is a planning term that's often used, and are right along these roadways. So without the technology to try to really abate some of these or mitigate some of these potential implications, whether through air conditioner or HVAC systems that would allow for the air to be a little better quality, it's a pretty big hit to senior housing that's being sited in these locations, to elementary schools, to parks, et cetera, that are being sited in these locations. And we're trying to push the planning agencies to really think through this a little more carefully.
This raises an important question about use of these peripheral land sites that developers will donate, because they can't put housing, the house won't sell, but they'll put a school there within earshot of the heavy traffic artery and heavily concreted area as well. But I think the underlying the purpose is to demonstrate how the heat vulnerability index, or the conferred by excessive bouts of excessive temperature, push the risk over the edge, is what Dr. Stone said. So it doesn't act independently from air pollution, but at what point does heat lower the dose response threshold conferred by poor air quality on cardiovascular and respiratory events? Yes, sir.
The second part, I'm not a modelist, I just say that up front, but I'm interested, based on where I've done the field research, is a place like Los Angeles or some other cities where there's significant topography and or altitude considerations because they're sprawling and they represent regions, or even for a compact city like Denver that's at altitude. I was wondering if anyone could comment how some of these models in the future could include altitude in terms of the topography, but also even high-rise buildings where rises, whether there's AC or not. And then also, do any of the models take into account wind or any of these onshore types of flows? Because I think that article from LA spells out really nicely that people just sometimes, if they can, will go to the coast for the day, or jump in the pool, or go vice versa, go out to the mountains. Well, there might be worse air quality, but at least it'd be cooler.
I'll take stat feet and stand up just because I'm behind this monitor. Measuring heat islands is notoriously dangerous business for all these reasons. It's one of the reasons that we're focused in this line of work on the extreme heat events, getting more at a health-related income than the heat island itself. And so it's complicated by a number of things. It's complicated by the morphology of the city. It's complicated by your reference point, what you're using as what you're comparing the city's temperature to. You know, how do we determine what is rural? How do we measure rural temperatures? So there are regional scale climate models that can represent the heat island well for a particular city. Running those models for, say, 50 cities is just not feasible to do. Measuring heat islands across multiple cities with satellite data is very difficult to do for many reasons. Essentially, you're not looking at three-dimensional surface, and so you're not capturing well the morphology effects. And so, and when we look at changing rates in heat islands, we could see that heat islands are growing because rural areas are cooling more rapidly. We could see they're growing because urban areas are heating up more rapidly. We could see they're growing because they're both cooling, but urban and rural areas are cooling more rapidly. So the heat island measure, it hasn't proven to be a very useful measure for associating with specific outcomes, is what I'm trying to say. And so we've been playing with other indicators of that when you're going to move beyond the single city, because of the points you both raised. It's just really hard to capture all those things. And I don't know if you guys have other thoughts on that.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
Oh, sure. But I guess the question, my institute was John, I'm with the National Institute of Infectious Diseases. The question that I had about urban heat was, are you aggregating it by susceptibility of different populations? Are you looking at different age groups and their susceptibility to extreme urban heat? And to the extent that the health or the infrastructure, be it public health infrastructure or buildings and that sort of thing, exacerbate excess mortality, particularly for aged citizens, if you're talking about rolling blackouts and extreme heat.
Well, I don't know if you were here for my talk, but the heat vulnerability index that we put together takes into account population above 65, and we don't have a way, so we were looking at age and other susceptibilities in the heat vulnerability index. we didn't have a measure of, I guess, when you talk about the public health infrastructure, sort of access to care in our heat vulnerability index, but I think that's highly correlated with some of the other variables that were in our index, particularly some of our socioeconomic variables that were in there.
I think, you know, a concern, Natalie kind of touched on it, is that if you're an individual, say 35, presumably healthy, but living with chronic disease like diabetes or asthma for 10 years, and just consider that they've already acquired another comorbidity, such as hypertension or dyslipidemia, how, you know, we could anticipate that the dose response threshold would drop even further when adjusting for those factors. So age is, as a function of disease status, is probably, I mean, I would envision the way to go. I think, you know, the mortality rates or the death certificates, some states will include second, third, and fourth underlying cause of death. But that's kind of an evolutionary process. But it's something to consider because most people don't die of diabetes. They'll die of a heart attack or a stroke. So you don't capture what the effect is having on these outcomes. And according to researchers at Emory University, 48% of the adult population under the age of 50 is living with two or more comorbidities. So it can only become a more significant problem. I'd like to wrap up with, if we could just give our presenters just one more round of applause.